Hello and welcome to the EdSurge podcast, where every week we look at the future of learning. I'm Jeff Young. I'm an editor and a reporter here at EdSurge. We're a nonprofit newsroom covering innovation in education. Ken Futernick brings together people who disagree deeply on issues that are most dividing school communities these days, such as teaching about gender and sexual identity, or how to teach the history of racism in America. The kind of people yelling at each other at school board meetings these days over issues like book bans are the kind of people he brings together to talk to each other about these issues. And he records the conversations. You might think the discussions would involve shouting matches or verbal fireworks. But Futernick, who has the calm demeanor of someone who might be teaching a yoga class, aims to keep these interactions as civil and as productive as possible. And in fact, he's on a quest to figure out how to diffuse the kind of overheated and polarized debates playing out in schools across the country. And he shares out these recorded conversations on his podcast called Courageous Conversations About Our Schools. For many of his episodes, he has invited on some of the leading thinkers in developing strategies to have better, more productive, less high-conflict conversations, including author Amanda Ripley and Columbia University professor Peter Coleman, who studies polarization. And then Futernick applies the lessons that he's learned from these guests when he brings together people who disagree on controversial education issues. Ken Futernick is a longtime educator who has served as an elementary school teacher, a teacher educator, and at one point as a leader of a national school turnaround center. Recent episodes he's done have tackled questions like, how do you balance parents' rights and students' rights? Who decides what students can read and what books get banned? And are teachers indoctrinating students? There has probably never been a harder time to do this podcast than Ken does. And if this podcast is hard to do now, it's probably only going to get tougher in the next few months as we near heading to the ballot box in November in this presidential election year. So since I learned about Ken's podcast, Courageous Conversations About Our Schools, I have been listening to it, and I've been eager to talk to him about what he's learned from the more than 20 episodes he's done so far. Here's my conversation with Ken Futernick. You know, one of the things I've learned from listening to your podcast, Ken, is that it's important to not just talk about, dive right into controversial issues. And so I, you know, get to know who you are and where you're coming from before we dive into this work. What are some things about you that somebody should know if they want to know who is Ken Futernick?
I spent most of my career as an educator. And one of the things that I mentioned before that I worked with WestEd and with struggling schools, and one of the things I noticed in schools that are struggling, from big high schools in LA to some of the elementary schools in Stockton where I worked for a few years, and then Nebraska and New York, is that where schools are struggling, it's common. It's more the norm than not to have relationships between administrators and teachers, and even between teachers and teachers, become frayed, and trust is lost. Not only is there no collaboration, sometimes they don't even, some teachers don't, they just stop speaking to each other, and that is never good. It ultimately causes some teachers to leave the profession.
They're not talking to each other because of why?
Sometimes they can't even remember, but usually you can trace it back to an incident. Some issue came up where there was disagreement about some school policy, and people lined up on one side of an issue or another, and it never got resolved, and they weren't able to say, let's just agree to disagree. And so it just becomes a wedge issue. Or there's an administrator that has some philosophical approach that some teachers agree with and others don't, and so they line up on one side or the other, and and remain divided. You know, the other thing I'll say, Jeff, is that and recently in my own community, I got so distressed by the level of political division in our community, I started up something called Bridging Divides El Dorado. El Dorado County is where I live, and went out to leaders in the community, starting with the education community, and then it sort of expanded to government and healthcare and nonprofits and the faith community, to say, would it be useful if we could come together and figure out how to bridge our divides, how to have better conversations, how to have less contempt for each other? And one of the questions I would ask people is, how many of you have become estranged over the past few years from friends or relatives? And almost everybody raises their hand, and nobody likes that. And so everyone, I find, is eager, if there is a way, to come together and bridge our divides. And I'm finding that that's often true in educational settings too. People don't like going to work and not being able to speak to other people, or fearful that what they do, that parents are going to come in and, you know, raise a stink about something they're doing that they've heard in the media is not a good idea. They're teaching about this or that, and they're now suspicious of teachers. And teachers are fleeing the profession in greater numbers than they have in the past, at a time when schools are not able to attract and keep enough of them.
Yeah. And so you got into this work, it sounds like, from a belief that, in a way, this was the key issue, of that we can't talk to each other.
Right, right. And of course, what brought me to courageous conversations about our schools was I became distressed about these, you know, so-called culture wars erupting all over the place. Initially it was around critical race theory, and then it expanded to concerns largely promoted through the media that, you know, teachers are sort of grooming kids. The Don't Say Gay law passed in Florida sort of expanded in other forms to other states. The idea was that somehow teachers are talking with young children about things that they shouldn't be, that they're sexualizing students, and we're talking about race and racism in ways that are dividing kids rather than bringing them together. And the conversations around those topics, which are important topics to be talking about, often don't go well. People will show up at school board meetings, line up, get their 3 minutes, yell at the school board, accuse them of things, and accuse teachers of doing things that in many cases weren't really true. But there's no other places in that most school districts have created to have civil, productive conversations. So the podcast I created is a place to do that. And, you know, I'll interview people too, like Monica Guzman, who has this great book, I Never Thought of It That Way, or Amanda Ripley, who has this best-selling book called High Conflict, How We Get Trapped and How We Get Out, to provide listeners and educators in particular, but school board members and parents, a different way to think about having conversations with people whose perspectives may differ than their own.
Yeah, so it seems like, you know, you're responding to what are being, you know, increasingly described as the culture wars within education. And I guess, just to sort of state the problem, do you feel like there is, you know, more, how would you describe how this kind of culture war has come to education in recent years in a way that's different than in the past?
You know, they and I'm glad you made reference to the past, because they have existed before around sex education. There have been from time to time concerns about the books kids have access to. But what's different about this one is that there are, because of social media and mainstream media, there are people promoting, and I would even say, as Amanda Ripley does, there are people out there that fall into the category of conflict entrepreneurs. These are people who promote conflict for conflict's sake because there's some political gain, financial gain in doing that. And all you have to do is convince parents that teachers are doing something and raise the sense of fear that, you know, you may not have been in school recently, but I'm here to tell you that when kids are going to school now, they're being indoctrinated into left-wing ideology. And if you haven't been in schools recently, or you're a parent of some kids, you're thinking, what? That doesn't sound right. And so you get your hackles raised up, and then there's not an easy way for people to find out, in fact, if that's true. So you hear it enough times and you begin to believe it. And then many people are motivated to show up and say, I don't want that. And I'm going to vote for laws that prevent that. But never is there an actual honest conversation with educators to say, gee, I've heard this. Is it true you're indoctrinating? And, you know, where teachers could say, I really would invite you to come into my classroom and watch, which usually how these things get resolved is if there's stronger relationships between parents and educators through courageous conversations and a little bit of empathy and approaching it with a sense of curiosity rather than coming into those conversations with suspicion and a sense of contempt for these so-called left-wing educators.
Yeah, no, you've done now over 20 episodes of your podcast, and it is notable that you bring on guests who don't agree with each other in many of these episodes, where you've had lawmakers who are putting forward some laws that that may be seen as restrictive to speech in some cases, and you've got educators, you've got students. How would you describe your sort of theory of like bringing an episode together like that?
You know, I'll use an example. There's a couple that come to mind that that were really inspiring to me. I'll share one. We did early on, I think it was episode 11, this teacher named Willie Carver, teacher of the year in Kentucky, high school teacher, goes to the White House with 49 other teachers and gets an award, you know, best teacher out of tens of thousands of teachers in the state, comes back, and within a few weeks, he starts to get harassed through social media and directly from a small group of parents who claim that he's grooming kids. Willie Carver is an openly gay teacher, married to a man, had a picture of himself and his husband in his classroom, and he would facilitate an after-school club where kids were invited to come and to get support for whatever issues they were dealing with. Sometimes they were issues around being LGBTQ in that community. So there was Willie on the one hand, and then I read an article by a guy named Doe Fisher. He's a conservative rabbi from Orange County in Southern California, and a lawyer, a very accomplished lawyer. And he had written an editorial in the Orange County Register saying that issues of sexuality and gender are entirely the business of parents. Schools should have nothing to do with it. And sort of implied that, you know, as others had done with Willie, that they're grooming, they're promoting something, and it's dangerous. And by the way, Willie Carver quit, the teacher of the year. So it's very, I think, unfortunate. So I spoke to both of them, said, I wonder if you'd be willing to have a conversation with each other, because I don't think you necessarily agree on this, but I'm wondering if we can have a conversation where you would come into the conversation with this idea that you're really going to try to understand the other person's position. And so they did. And I did something that Amanda Ripley refers to as looping, when one person would say, this is my position about what schools should do when it comes to to gender and sexuality, the other person would summarize briefly what they thought they heard, and I'd ask.
On the spot, say to the person who disagrees, like, you summarize the other person's point based on what you just heard.
Right, without judgment. No, you know, don't say whether you agree or not, and then ask them if you got it right. And in both cases, both Willie and Dove, after they heard the other person summarize their position, said something to the effect that you said it better than I did. And so there was immediately sort of a sense of they weren't at each other's throats at all. They kind of appreciated the fact that the other person was willing to hear them and make sure they understood them. And then as the conversation went along, something really interesting happened. They started to realize that they really didn't disagree very much. And Doe Fisher acknowledged the fact when Willie Carver said, I've had students who would not be alive today were it not for my being the only person in their life that said, I care about you, I want you in school, and you are an okay person. And he said some of those students actually aren't alive. And I know because of the harassment and the lack of support. And Doe Fisher says, Willie, I have tremendous admiration for what you do. And I can imagine there are some really bad, unsupportive parents out there, probably not many, who don't support their kids in the way they should. So I admire you. And then he said, you know, really, I'm beginning to realize as a Jew growing up in New York, I always felt like I was the other, being Jewish. You know, the holidays in school were always focused around Christmas. It was a Christian orientation in school, and I was Jewish. It was sometimes teased and bullied, and I've never felt fully American as an American. And what I'm hearing you say, Willie, as a gay man, you have felt as the other, and so much so that you had to quit your job. And you know, so by the end of the conversation, they each called each other a friend, and I think we agree on a lot of things that I didn't think we would agree on. And so the way we had that conversation, the way they had it with each other, and they really listened to each other, they were able to discover that they weren't very far apart, as it turned out.
Yeah, I think I've listened to some of these, and it is interesting, these moments. It is, there are a couple things that have struck me, though, in the podcast and the advice that comes on there. And I want to ask you in a minute for some of your advice for our listeners. But the one of the things that struck me is how much time that it takes to get to any point like you're describing, where someone might sort of question their own belief a little bit in a way that gets at a productive learning between disagreeing sides. And I guess it seems like, obviously your forum, your podcast, you're trying to create that space to do that. But it does seem like it seems hard in our world that we live in to have spaces like that. And to, I guess sometimes in a way I listen to it and I'm like, wow, like it's, so there's a way, you know, to get these conversations to happen, but it feels so hard that it's almost discouraging in a way, because where will these conversations take place in reality that everyone's living in as teachers and students and leaders?
You know, let me say a couple of things about that. One is, if we agree that the stakes are really high, that schools are going to suffer, kids' education is going to suffer, teachers themselves and administrators are going to suffer, and many will leave if they continue to work in toxic environments that are divided. So if we agree on the premise that this is a really serious problem from an education standpoint, and I would argue it's a problem in our communities and our democracy. So if we start there, the other thing I would say is that I have found in my work in the bridging work I do up in my county, face-to-face meetings with just ordinary citizens and leaders in the community, but also on the podcast, that it actually, it doesn't take very much time to get people to discover a couple of strategies of communication and building trust that where people come away from it going, boy, that's really a much better way to approach this situation than I was using before. Just this idea of promoting empathy for others, which I've written about this in a blog on the website, doesn't mean that you're endorsing someone else's point of view. But if you approach another person, try to empathize, understand where they're coming from, how they may have come to believe what they believe, you listen well without judgment, people discover pretty quickly that I don't really hate that person. In fact, maybe we can find some common ground. As Amanda Ripley says, there's this paradox about high conflict. She goes, we're drawn into conflict. We sort of, see a fight going, or we want to stand up and affirm our connection to our in-group and affirm our lack of connection to the others. But then we're also, someone presents us with the opportunity to do it differently, to sort of make peace and to try to figure out a way to get along, even if we have to agree to disagree. We're also drawn to that approach, which she says is an interesting paradox about conflict. And I just have found, Jeff, that it just doesn't take too much if people practice and see it and hear it to say, I think I'm going to try it a different way.
You know, I am also a fan of Amanda Ripley's work and have read some of her advice. And we certainly cover controversial topics here at EdSurge. And we're one of the things that I've struggled with, though, is to actually put these into practice. Because, for instance, we did a podcast series a couple years ago called Bootstraps. And we were looking at, issues of equity in education. And we, one of the episodes centered on a controversy at Thomas Jefferson High School. It's a public high school in the DC suburbs. That is, it is actually, US News ranks it the best public high school in the country. And it has an admissions test to get in, as many, magnet schools do. And the school leaders in recent years have tried to change the admissions process to make it more equitable because they were noticing, that certain groups were consistently left behind in accessing the school. And it created one of these moments that you've referenced where the parents are going to school board meetings and yelling with 3 minutes at a time and not necessarily hearing each other, but very, very high emotions, very high conflict. And so I invited a couple parents, one on each side of the issue, and we talked for hours on this Zoom call that I put together, and it was very interesting. But I do think that I didn't quite succeed in pulling off the strategies, but I feel like there was a lot of pressure after this episode and after this conversation of these two humans to then go back to their sides and just go back to the struggle and fight, because they both believe passionately in their view on which way the admission system should work, and they don't agree. So I guess it is tricky to it feels like to have, in this world we live in where, people are trying to put forth policy and at the same time, we're all trying to live in the world and be civil to each other, to balance it when it seems like there are so many of these political fights that people are part of, and they go back to their, in the end of the day, they go back to their friend groups and they go back to their side of the of living where they do and on the side they do. And I guess it does feel challenging to enact or get back to a place where people can kind of disagree and maybe even lose for a little while on some issue in the of policy that they disagree with and still have a civil kind of discourse, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, I think one of the problems in school settings is that the only place for civic engagement typically is in a school board meeting. And school board meetings are terrible places for dialogue because people in the public comment section of a board meeting get 3 minutes. You typically only get people who have the courage to stand up and do public speaking, which many people are afraid to do. So you've already pre-selected a group of people willing to do that. They say what they want to say. They can say pretty much anything they want to say. And it's not typically challenged. And people say, boy, if that's what public engagement looks like, we know we have to do it by law, but we don't want any more of that. Well, there is something that I've done and others. I sort of follow a model from living room conversations. And I do something called schoolhouse conversations where you, in an informal setting, you would invite people to come together like you did to talk about admissions policies or, I've done schoolhouse conversations that begin with the question, what is it that we like and are proud of with our school or our district? And that's a good place to start because it people often agree with those things and they realize, oh yeah, that's, we have a great arts and music program and we're really proud of that or whatever it is. And then say, what would be something you would say would strengthen our district? And the rules of these schoolhouse conversations is that you simply listen. You get 2 or 3 minutes in a small group to say what you say. And then, the third question is usually something, what's your takeaway from this and how we had the conversation? And often what you can do, too, is have your school leaders not lead it, but actually sit and they can participate in it, but then listen to what parents or teachers or students said in their groups. With the idea that we as leaders are here to learn and to listen to you, not to tell you what we're trying to do and why we're doing it and then take questions from you. And so if you create that kind of civic space with a few simple rules, we're not going to interrupt, we're going to be curious and not have this become a debate, we're trying to learn from each other, then I think the kind of interesting, nuanced, complicated discussion around school admissions or how do we teach about race and history, or what's the role, how should students learn about gender and sexual identity? Under those conditions, with those guardrails up, people come away saying, that worked, I learned something, and I'd like to come back. So on the heels of your podcast around that, if people had gone back with this idea that we're going to then invite our friends on both sides to come together and to get more people involved in this, maybe there would be a chance that it wouldn't simply go back and become polarized again.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that gets to this issue of like one person can't end the polarization solo.
Yeah, that's for sure.
And that's been a theme on your podcast from what I hear.
Yeah, it really is. And there's something else, Peter Coleman, who I've interviewed for the podcast at Columbia University, has written a lot about toxic polarization. He says there's something called, he refers to it as the friend problem. And so it's when people like you or me that, that read Amanda Ripley and such, yeah, I'm going to try to approach people, political opponents or people with very different views, differently. I'm going to listen to them, give them a little bit of airtime, which seems to can make you a little nervous, like I'm giving a person airtime who I really don't agree with. But if you listen to them, your friends and others can say to you, why would you do that? They have abhorrent points of view. And But there's this guy, Daryl Davis. I don't know if you know Daryl Davis. He just came across, I got an email as a YouTube video with him. I think he's got a podcast. Daryl Davis lives in South Carolina. I think he still lives there. He's a black man. He was a musician. He played in bars and people come and listen to him. Some of the people that came to listen to him were members of the KKK. And he knew that they were, and he went out of his way, a black man, to invite them to go have coffee with him, have lunch with them, and to have conversations with them. Well, this is well documented, but over a period of several years, over 200 members of the KKK that Daryl Davis met and formed a relationship with and inevitably would ask the question, how is it that you could hate me when you don't even know who I am? And in over 200 cases, those members of the KKK handed their robes to Daryl Davis and said, I'm no longer a member. And it was by establishing a relationship and him not holding them in contempt, not attacking them, but listening to them, which seems totally counterintuitive. And I'm sure to some of your listeners, why in the world would you ever want to listen to someone with abhorrent views like that? But in Daryl's case, he listened to them. And after forming a relationship and questioning their own tribal affiliations, agreed that that was not a good place for them to be.
Yeah, you mentioned the climate we're in and some of the forces out there these days that contribute to some of the polarizing conversations. And you know, one of those that we've talked about on our podcast is, and in elsewhere in EdSurge, is how technology and social media is part of that landscape. And you mentioned the Amanda Ripley line of the conflict entrepreneurs, which, you know, it gets at that. And I think she includes among those some of the social media, the tech companies that benefit from people engaging and creating a kind of addictive environment that you want to come back to your, you know, kind of these apps. If people are stirred up to high emotional levels, it does create that question there of like, what can be done and specifically in a school setting and around education issues, in the environment that we're in with these technologies that are just kind of ubiquitous out there right now.
Yeah, you know, communications and social media, media in general, you're a journalist. I mean, you know, communication, it's a really important thing, feature of a democracy, a democratic society. The problem, of course, is that in where you have a free press, people, we're running up against this tension with what is it okay for people to say? And can you, in social media, promote hate speech or say hateful things or publish things that are simply false? And there's a tension around that. It's like, you know, people should be able to, I guess, say what they want. In school settings, it's become so serious, the cyberbullying that goes on and the kids sort of are addicted to social media. They can't not do it. But when they're on it, there's this well-documented trend of anxiety related to participation in social media. I don't have an answer, but I do think we have to have conversations with students, with teachers, with parents about that and to acknowledge that it's a problem. I think some of the people promoting empathy in schools and sort of character building recommend having conversations with students very early in school, you know, first, second grade, about how to have conversations or how should we treat each other. And it needs to start there. And when you don't feel that you've been treated well, how can we enable you to share that with the person that did something that hurt you? you know, rather than either staying away from them or fighting back. And I think if those skills, those conflict resolution skills, that sense of empathy is focused on early in school and throughout school, that's one way to begin to approach this. But I think right now we've sort of all thrown up our hands and say, what are we gonna do about it?
Yeah, I mean, I think there is that danger of feeling overwhelmed and powerless in the face of all these forces we're talking about. So I did want to ask you, from, you know, these 20 plus episodes you've done and the work you're doing, where you're working with schools to try to work through, you know, kind of combating some of these toxic environments. What's one key or one most surprising or most kind of resonant thing you've learned in your engagement with this so far?
You know, let me speak personally. When I started doing this, I thought I want to have courageous conversations, see if I can get people with opposing positions, political opponents, to come together. I wasn't sure, A, if people would want to do it, and B, if they did do it, whether anything good would come out of it. I also approached this work in my local community, working with, and I live in a pretty red county, relatively speaking, for California, a very blue state. And so I started reaching out and spending time with people whose political positions are very different from mine. And I have, A, discovered how gratifying and satisfying the work is for me, that I just realized that I was myself living with a lot of anxiety about and sort of toxic assumptions about other people and those people, in a sense of contempt. And so entering this work and communicating with people in the podcast, conservatives and people with very different views, I'm just personally feel that a burden has been lifted, that I'm pleasantly surprised that so many of the people that I'm engaged with and the people that engage with each other on the podcast come away feeling that there is a better way to do this, and that we come away often finding much more common ground than we thought. And it gives me a sense of hope and that this approach and you know, there's this bridging movement, this depolarizing movement is much, much bigger than me. And I benefit by learning from people like Amanda Ripley and the Listen First Coalition and the Starts With Us group. There's people all over the country that recognize the same problem, that are doing great work along the lines of what you and I are talking about. And it's growing, it's expanding. New people that didn't think this kind of thing would work are getting drawn into it. And so I'm hopeful that this is a counterbalance to the increasingly toxic environment we live in. And it's going to be really critical this year because it's an election year. And I'm really worried about where this is, what things are going to look like a few months from now when we get closer to the election.
And no, it's a nice point of optimism from your own experiences engaging and sort of gathering people. I guess for schools and teachers and school leaders, is there something you found that can get a bridging kind of vibe going? What is a way that you've seen seen something where there is one of these issues that's bubbled up and something is, you know, there's some effort to ban books in a particular school, say, or some very hot issue has come in, to do anything like diffuse, to try to have a conversation about something like that?
Well, let me just share an example. When I mentioned earlier that I had worked with WestEd and worked with some of the lowest performing schools in the country. In what we found in those schools, and is that the people have sort of become polarized. They were on one side or another. People just stopped talking to each other. Very little trust. And so before we could start focusing on teaching and learning and curriculum to turn these schools around and have to try to see better outcomes for their students, we had to try to repair the relationships among the people at the school. So this is a little different than your question of an issue that came up and how did we sort it through. But this was just relationships that gotten frayed. And so there's an elementary school in Stockton. I actually have written about it in a book that I wrote about collaboration among labor unions and management. And when we asked a survey of all the teachers at one particular elementary school how much they felt there was trust among staff and administration among all the people of the school, it was very low. How much did they enjoy coming to work? Not many people enjoyed it. So we got everyone to agree to come together voluntarily to an after-school meeting and said, what if we were able to sort of define a different future for all of us and not go back and try to change the past, because that's impossible. But if we could list the kind of values we'd like to live by as a school community, and they listed, you know, integrity, honesty, trust, things like that. And I said, what does that actually look like in terms of what you will do and what you won't do? And they say, you know, when we walk past each other, we ought to always acknowledge each other, say hello, wave, and not ignore each other. I mean, it's a simple little thing, but they came up with a list. And at the end of that meeting, and we actually did this in several schools, how many of you are willing to abide by these values you came up with and these sort of things you will and won't do? And virtually everyone says, I'm willing to commit to it. And then, you know, a month later, we come back and say, I can guarantee you it's going to go off the rail, or it's going to seem like it did at one point or another. We need to come back and talk about how do you have a conversation when that happens. So to make we did this for several months, and we conducted that survey about how much trust they felt, and a year later, and it was at 90%, and people felt, 90% of people enjoy coming to work. And the really cool thing was that of the 50 schools in Stockton Unified, this one school that had been near the bottom academically was the fastest growing school academically of all 50 schools. And we hadn't even begun focusing on teaching and learning yet. It was just repairing relationships. And I suspect when teachers said, you know, felt like they liked coming to work, they'd like being with each other, there wasn't that toxic environment that just had to affect their morale, it affected their teaching. And so, you know, there's an example of repairing relationships. People weren't getting along. They didn't like that. We figured out a way to define a new future. They defined it, and they committed to it, and it held.
Oh, that's interesting. I think that's a really interesting point about having, you know, it goes back to your hypothesis, if you will, of that the bigger problem is the relationships. And if that gets resolved, then other positive things around what you'd think a school would do, like academics and teaching, would be improved.
Peter Coleman refers to it as a first order problem. This problem contributes to so many other problems. There was a faith-based minister in our community, and when we approached him, said, "Would you come to our meeting to work on this bridging divide stuff?" He said, "I've got so many things on my plate, I couldn't possibly." And teachers might say this too. I don't want to do another PD about how we get along or how we. And
it seems like a side note. This seems like a side issue somehow.
Yeah, that's right. And what I said to him was, I think that if we can get this thing right and our communication levels of trust go up, you're going to have less things on your plate because people are going to step up and say, how can I help? I want to be part of this. And so it was some version of saying what Peter Coleman says, it's a first order problem. If we can address this somewhat successfully, it's going to resolve a number of other problems. So you can't afford not to deal with this and allow it to persist. I don't think we as a society can afford to let it persist.
No, and you mentioned that it's election year and nobody, you know, kind of, no, that's a surprise to nobody as we head into, you know, more and more drumbeat of the political coverage. And it is going to be maybe more challenging along these issues in the coming months. And I don't know. I guess I'm wondering, do you ever get discouraged in this work? And what do you do to stay as positive as it sounds like you are overall?
You know, I let me just say one thing, Jeff, because I think there is an interesting, you know, there's a Newton's laws of thermodynamics, you know, for every action, one direction is equal and opposite reaction. As things become more tense, more difficult, more divided, more toxic, more polarized, I think that this group that Peter Coleman and others identify as the exhausted majority, that there more and more people are going to say, throw their hands up and say, we can't have, this is not good for us personally, it's not good for our families, it's not good for our schools, it's not good for our communities or our country. And it may be what, you know, what we know about some people who have drug addiction or alcoholism, you have to hit rock bottom before you say, you wake up and say, we have to do this differently. What I hope is that that rock bottom isn't so awful that there's irreparable damage done. But I think what I'm optimistic about is that people, more and more people are recognizing that it's hurting their relationships, it's hurting the quality of their own personal life. They don't like teaching as much as they did before. They don't like people making accusations about what they're doing or what they think they're doing. And that people react and say, we have to find a better way. And if there are examples of a better way to do things, I think people, more and more people are going to say, I'm in. I want to find out how to have a schoolhouse conversation. But I, it's not to say I don't get discouraged sometimes. I think the only thing I'm discouraged about is how do we expand this work? How do we invite more people in to be part of it? That I feel sometimes I'm just, you know, with hundreds or thousands of listeners, you know, you're scratching the surface. And my hope is that those people that participate, hear these kinds of things, read books like Amanda Ripley's, Monica's, and Peter Coleman's, are putting into practice those things, and those things are affecting other people, and that it will spread. That's my hope. But it's sort of a race. Can we push this depolarizing agenda fast enough to prevent us from going over a cliff?
If you have time, there's one other issue I want to raise, which is, you know, I think it's interesting because the one of the things that I've heard come up in some of the interviews you've done is really a fundamental question of what is the purpose of school and education. And, you know, I think there's a lot of talk these days about, you know, in a way, questions about, is it about getting a job? Is it about becoming citizens? Is it about, you know, and it seems like that there's been a history in school and college of it being a place where people can disagree, that disagreement has been and learn how to do that so that after school, when the stakes are even higher and policy debates are happening in, you know, kind of other forums of work and politics, then people are prepared. And that, I guess I'm wondering, if how much, in a way, we don't agree anymore on that in the way we maybe did at some earlier point in America. Has that been lost a little bit? Has that point of education slipped away somewhat in maybe the way we do standardized tests measuring for whether, you know, like people have the right academic achievement or, you know, whatever reason that might have happened? Are you feeling like there is a bit of a need to, in a way, go back to talking about what we created schools and colleges for in the first place?
I do think so. And what I often do, and I don't always include this in the podcast because listeners wouldn't necessarily want to hear this part, but it's a really important thing. And I ask participants to start by recalling a teacher that made a difference in their life. Invariably they sort of sit back and smile. Oh, it was Miss So-and-so. It was Mr. So-and-so. And over the course of a minute or two, they describe something, said, that person said this, it changed my life. And when people go around and do that, what it does is it humanizes the conversation, but it also does what you're getting at, is it reminds us of, you know, mostly what people remember about a teacher is, you know, how they made them feel. They felt supported. They opened their eyes to something. You know, it wasn't that I really was struggling to understand quadratic equations, and were it not for that teacher, I would never have understood that. It's bigger than
right.
That.
It's not like the rating on a YouTube video on how to. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. It's. They opened their eyes to think about something differently, or made them feel that they belonged, or that they were capable, more capable than they had felt. And everyone sort of agrees on, you know, that's what great teachers do. And last week I was on a Zoom call listening in on the state of social emotional learning. And it wasn't very long ago when people, you know, would nod their heads and say, boy, that's a really important thing. We all want that for our kids, to learn how to manage their emotions, to develop emotionally and socially, you know, to not bully and to know how to respond to bullies. But now, of course, the culture wars and the conflicts, entrepreneurs have promoted this idea that somehow those people promoting SEL, it's a sneaky way for them to indoctrinate your kids into. But actually, if you sit down with people and you say, what was the teacher that made a difference for you? And do you remember when we used to get citizenship grades? It was really about how you treated other people. And, that, you know, that was an important. Oh, yeah. You know, people. So when you actually talk about these things, or how about just watch this teacher teach? And watch how they respond when a kids start laughing at a response to someone else, and how they help those kids understand why that is not acceptable and why it hurts other people. When they see that and hear that and talk about that, they go, "Oh yeah, I want that for my kids. I want that for our society." But you have these conflict entrepreneurs pushing mythology about so many things that it stokes fear. And when people get fearful, they get angry, and that's where the next place that should go is a courageous, open conversation. I'm concerned about this. Can you tell me why you're promoting SEL? Great. I thank you for the question. We'd invite you to come in and have our teachers talk to you about it, and even invite you to come in and watch teachers doing it, because I think you'll end up coming away saying thank you for doing that.
Right, but that's not often the way it goes down these days.
No, it isn't.
Yeah,
I will say I had one. I have another podcast that I did for many years called Teacher Stories, and did a series that we're actually going to move over to the Courageous Conversation podcast. It's a history teacher in Fremont, California, in a very conservative community that she says, I teach history and always have very, very honestly. I don't hold back. And we talk about the the good, the bad, and the ugly, because I want kids to understand, you know, the point of history is to learn from it so we can not repeat things that have happened in the past that shouldn't be repeated. But I make a point of communicating regularly with my parents about my history curriculum and why we do it. I invite them to come in and sit in on the movies we show. And the principal was on the podcast. He said, I wholeheartedly support it. She develops this trust with her parents. They love her as a teacher. And she is a liberal educator that doesn't try to promote liberal thinking. She just wants to promote critical thinking and teach us history honestly. She says, I've never gotten a complaint from the parent because of that relationship she establishes with her parents. And she's very transparent, invites them in. Do you have a concern? So it is possible. But some teachers might say, look, I have a hard enough time coming into class and teaching kids. I don't, you know, have time to go out and communicate that much with parents and try to allay their fears. I guess what I'd say is if we don't do that in this climate, in these divided times, then kids aren't going to be, you're going to feel tension or pressure, criticism about what you're doing. And parents are going to question what you're doing. And so it may be worth it to take the time to have these conversations with parents as a proactive measure to instill, to kind of create a sense of trust in what you're doing so that they come away going, I'm thankful. I appreciate what you're doing with our kids.
Yeah, I guess it is ultimately about convincing people. It seems like a big theme of our conversation is to convince people that this is something that is going to take energy, but is worth the energy because of the downstream effects it has on just about all other aspects of education.
Yeah, I think that you put it just right. It's if we don't do this, the costs are much greater than simply living with it.
Well, I think we'll leave it at that. If we could go on, but thank you so much for joining us today.
Yeah, sure thing, Jeff. I've really enjoyed it. I love your work and your podcast, and I hope we stay connected.
Yeah, same. Thank you. This has been the EdSurge podcast. Every week, we bring you conversations like this one. If you like the show, I hope you will follow the EdSurge podcast wherever you listen. And please tell a friend about the show or let others know about it on social media so we can continue to grow. Editing this episode by Rebecca Koenig and music by Komaku. We'll be back next week with more on the future of learning. Thank you for listening.